welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Later in today's show, Christopher Zimmerman will join us again to preview the upcoming season of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra, where he's served as music director since 2013. But first, we're joined by Dr. Dan Ostley, an orthopedics and sports medicine specialist with Essentia Health. He's with us to discuss some of the most important questions parents have about their children's involvement in contact sports. Whether your child is just starting out or already involved, Dr. Ostley will share valuable insights on when kids should start playing sports like tackle football or hockey, how to keep them safe, and how to recognize potential injuries. It's a conversation you won't want to miss. Dr. Dan Ostley, welcome to Main Street.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The idea of visiting with you today is to provide information about sports, and particularly youth sports, and head injuries, and what parents really should be thinking about. Mm-hmm. There's the whole gamut of sports. We see hockey, we see lacrosse, we see football, of course. And as a parent, I've wondered if I made good decisions when my kids were coming through the system.
Sure.
My kids played football, played college football, played very aggressively in soccer. And now today we have a lot of different information, I think. So let me ask you, as we begin, what age should parents really kind of think about allowing their kids to play contact sports?
Sure.
What thoughts should be going into that decision?
Yeah. Well, I think the first part is just maybe taking a step back and saying, you know, what level of risk do people feel comfortable with? When you drove to this interview today, you had to drive in your car, and there's a little bit of risk that you could get in a car accident and get hurt. And, you know, we sort of just blow that to the side. But, you know, when we do life, we have some risk with things we choose. So I think, you know, taking a step back first is just to say that there's nothing we can do in sports and life without zero risk. When it comes to youth in sports, there's a couple of things we know. On a positive, our youngest athletes, they're a little smaller, they're maybe not as fast. So some of those ligament or musculoskeletal injuries are actually a little bit less common when they're little. So that's maybe a positive. On a negative, we know that their brains are not as well developed. And so we know their brains are a little more vulnerable to injury at those younger ages. And we also know that their ability to avoid injury or avoid contact, so being able to foresee that contact's coming, or maybe have really great tackling technique or blocking technique, or reduce the chance of a blow, they're not as sophisticated at those youngest ages. So we really want to protect those young ones from head injuries in particular. USA Hockey, of course, they do not allow checking until age 13. So 12 and under, they don't allow checking. And football's a little bit all over the place. But I think there's some data out there now. A lot of the medical experts probably are saying maybe contact sports, either avoid that or try and reduce that until middle school, so around age 13, 14.
Parents look at some of these headlines and think, geez, they're protected, right?
Yeah.
And I think that technology has done a very good job of protecting the skull.
Mm-hmm.
But the brain moves around inside the head a little bit.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that and how concussions happen.
Sure. Well, you're right on the money. Part of why the helmets are perfectly round and smooth and slippery is it's really hard to get a direct blow to the helmet. There's a lot of glancing blows, which is a good thing. And helmets just get better and better as far as their protection and those types of things. You're absolutely right that not every concussion is from getting hit in the head or a blow to the head. Just as the brain is moving fast, it can have an acceleration type of injury to the brain, or a deceleration or a slowing down type of injury. So just think in a whiplash or a car accident, that brain can slosh to the front or back of the skull, leading to a brain injury.
Regardless of how the head's protected.
Even if the head never hit anything. And so obviously helmets and guardian things and things like that in those situations don't make a difference. They do make a difference with blows to the head. So certainly rugby compared to football would have different types of protections or less protections with getting hit directly to the head. But they're not perfect, for sure.
Is there any technology you've come across maybe that could be helpful, or is the verdict kind of still out there on whether or not we can really make a difference here?
I think the verdict is still out there. You know, the one that I just saw locally in the newspaper were on the Guardian helmet shields. And anecdotally, if you talk to the coaches in town, they do believe there's maybe less concussion or head injury in practice and things. But the data is pretty mixed. The NFL basically endorsed using that in practices and potentially games, but they didn't really release any data on where they came up with that. And so the research, there's been some research saying they work well at reducing concussion, and there's also research that says, hey, they don't really work at all. So we really don't have a great double-blinded, placebo-controlled study of Guardian helmets or some of these other equipment things to know if they truly are effective at reducing concussion.
Are there physical milestones, both for boys and both for girls, that parents should look at or to give themselves more confidence and then allowing more aggressive, more contact-riddled sports, I guess?
I think part of it is knowing your kid and knowing your family. You know, you have some boys and girls, they're, you can just tell they're aggressive. They're wrestling their older brothers at young ages, and they're jumping off of furniture, and they've got bruises and scratches all over the front of their shins. You know, that's a really aggressive kid, and good body control, that type of child's probably more amenable or more, you know, probably would do well in contact type sports. And then you have some other kids that maybe like being a little bit more inside or reading or doing art or working in the kitchen. Some of those people may enjoy other types of activities, and that's okay. You don't have to feel the peer pressure that just because your classmates are in contact sports, that's good for some kids, and some probably are better at going a different direction.
Are there precautions that parents should take as their kids begin to engage in contact sports? And I guess not wanting to be that parent, but making sure that children do have proper equipment,
yeah,
that they do understand how conditioning impacts their ability to participate in sports.
Sure. I think the first is, you know, establishing, are the parents ready? You know, do you as a family, again, as we talked about, there's always some small level of risk with most everything we do. So as parents, are you fine with that being part of your family and your child that's going to participate in sports? Is your child ready? You know, are they physically able to participate in the sport and have skills and develop and follow directions? You know, some kids are really good at following directions and learning and making adjustments, and some really are not really listening and don't follow directions and don't really make changes. And so that person would have more risk. So those would be just some things family-wise. You know, when it comes to equipment and things like that, you know, you really want to make sure that if you join up for an organization that they have, you know, the best equipment. So in football, you want to make sure they have great helmets, great shoulder pads. You know, reduce the risk as best you can. You don't want old equipment or old things that are falling apart. You would want coaches to be trained in spotting, you know, whether or not kids have injuries or concussions. So if coaches have some training in that, or the referees, or certainly if the administration has some emphasis on that, you're more likely to see things before they get too out of hand. And so those would be a few examples of some things to start with.
Seems to me leagues these days should mandate training, at least on the observation of whether a child is concussed or not.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's kind of two main spots. You know, at the younger levels, it's usually club sports, right? So you would want to know that the superintendent or the leader or the owner of the club sport has an interest in injury prevention, and that hopefully they'll have things in place to train the coaches and train the people involved with your student so that they can see concussion or see injury, intervene, and provide the best treatment possible. You know, as they get older, they're usually at the high school level. So superintendent, athletic director, coach, at that level, very often you want to make sure they have athletic trainers certified on the sidelines. Do they have a team physician? Are there other people involved that can really help these athletes before and then after they sustain an injury?
I'm guessing the parents whose kids go to the bigger high schools say, yeah, we've seen all that stuff. And maybe the parents whose kids go to smaller high schools are saying, what?
Yep, for sure. You know, obviously at the professional level or the high college level, they'll have an ambulance on site and certainly an increased level of care. I think we all saw the DeMar Hamlin situation with the Buffalo Bills that, you know, they literally had emergency personnel right there on top of him almost immediately. You know, if you're in a rural community, you may not have those same resources, but making the best of what you have, you know, certainly having an athletic trainer or a coach that's at least certified in CPR, I think those type of things make a lot of sense.
Has had more training, perhaps. We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Dan Ostley. He's an orthopedic and sports medicine physician with Essentia Health. What are warning signs that parents should really be conscious of to indicate whether their child may have suffered a concussion or a head injury? And then what should the parent do?
Sure. There's a lot of them, but some of the common ones, you know, the first is, did you witness them taking a blow? So if you see your child get smoked in on the hockey rink or on the football field, seeing the blow is the first part that can be very helpful. Are they woozy? Are they lightheaded? Do they seem kind of glassy-eyed? Those can be some signs in the first, you know, few minutes. Are they having trouble with their balance? Are they having trouble with memory? Those types of things. And certainly, as you go through days afterward, they might be grouchy. They may have a different affect or personality. Sometimes they're not eating the same. They may have sensitivity to light or loud noises. So there's quite a few different things that can show up. They may have trouble with school. Those would be some of the things you'd want to watch for as a parent. And if you have any concern, you know, having them see a medical professional. As far as intervention, you know, once you have those things, you know, you'd want to get seen by someone who is familiar with concussion, but then also, you know, to go through the appropriate treatments. Most of the time it's rest and getting appropriate sleep and reducing some of the stimulus that they may have in their life.
How does a parent know whether this is an emergency?
That's a good question. Sometimes it is hard, but certainly if they're having trouble with consciousness, so if they're passing out, I would say that's going to be much more of an emergency. If they're having nausea and vomiting, if they're kind of really having a hard time with balance and falling over, you know, some of those types of things sound a little more serious. They very often would be at the beginning of the injury. And so if you have those things, I certainly would take your child to the emergency room.
We talked about this a little bit ago, but I want to dive deeper into it. What questions should parents ask? What legitimate questions should they ask their leagues and their coaches without trying to be overbearing?
Yeah, I don't think it's overbearing to learn about the league. So I think it's okay for parents to interview the director or someone in charge of the league, you know, find out where they stand for. You know, what's the culture? Is the culture of winning? Is it a culture of safety? Is it a culture of participation? You know, just figure out what the culture is. I do think from there, then some real specifics. Find out, you know, who is trained in medical areas for injury or head injury specifically. You know, does the coach have training? Does the superintendent or the director of the organization have training? Are there going to be any doctors, nurses, or medical professionals on the sidelines? How about athletic training? Are they at the events? I think those types of things are helpful. Interestingly, we have quite a few physicians, nurses, EMTs in our community. So sometimes even finding out, are there moms or dads of your team that are attending games that have medical training? That can be very helpful. So I would, you know, interview and find out that information so that you have just a global look on what your child's getting into.
I've come to understand that some programs do baseline trainings for their baseline assessments mm-hmm. for their athletes. They might have them go in front of a computer and respond to different software stimuli. And now we know kind of a baseline
yeah.
and maybe can compare that against something later on. Is that all well and good?
It is. It's a good tool. It's not the only tool for assessing concussion and then return to play. You know, those are kind of the two main things you think about: assessing, have they had a concussion, and then when is it safe to return? So it is a tool. It measures just how quick you can process information when you're feeling normal, and then you can compare that to how well they are processing information when they've been hit or injured. So it's not the end-all be-all, but it certainly is a nice tool if they have it. But it does require a fair amount of manpower, and it costs money, and so at some levels they don't feel like that's worth it. And other levels, it's very routine for all of the athletes in contact sports to have that pre-baseline testing.
I want to get down into the weeds just a little bit, but do we have any long-term data that talks about the physical and mental health risks of youth participating in contact sports?
You know, what we do know is that any hit to the head is not great. And cumulatively, you know, 10 hits is worse than zero, 50 is worse than 10, 1,000 is worse than 50. So over time, the more hits to the head you have, we know that that's probably not great. And so there is some research or some data looking at some of these hits to the head that maybe don't create a concussion, but maybe stack up over time. And so we are a little concerned about the cumulative nature of hits to the head. And certainly we've made some good progress. I think there's less hitting and less tackling to the ground in practice at the pro level, high school. I think at all levels, there's just, I think practices and some of those loads have reduced. And I think that's a really good thing. There is a tricky component that to play the sport, you want to have good fundamentals and good techniques. So you have to learn how to tackle and how to block and how to do things to be effective at the sport, but also to protect yourself. So how do you balance, you know, having some level of contact so that they're prepared for game situations, but also reducing those levels so they don't get too much. We do think it's cumulative though over time. And so when you think of athletes that have been in the news with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, many of them have had either large, significant concussive blows or cumulative blows over time that seems to cross some threshold where they end up with disease.
Are there policies that should be looked at maybe at a from a state legislature basis to regulate some of this, or from a federal level to regulate some of the things that happen in youth sports relative to injury prevention?
Yeah. It's an interesting thing because it's a good question. I think the challenge is that we don't have black and white information for everything. And so to have a federal mandate that would say, hey, no contact sports until age 17, or you have to do this, I think it's a little tricky because is that backed by awesome research data or not? Again, back to living your life, we do have these lives. There is more risk when you hike in the mountains than if you just hike on a trail. And we have to just be okay and live amongst some level of risk to do our lives and have happiness and joy. And certainly there's a lot of benefits with sports, everything from, you know, working towards a common goal and friendships, doing better in academics, being part of a team, creating memories, and obviously the physical and cardiovascular benefits of just being active. So we have to be okay weighing all those things. I do think that at the youngest age groups, to have perhaps some level of protection for our most vulnerable would be appropriate. Whether that should be coming all the way from the federal government or at the local level, I'm not sure.
My wife and I walk in some of the indoor facilities that are here in the area, but I've noticed that there are trainers with some fairly young kids doing one-on-one physical training with some kids that look to me that they might be fifth graders or sixth graders. And it kind of blows my mind a little bit that they're so focused maybe or are concerned about physical development at such a young age. What advice would you tell parents relative to conditioning and preparing to compete?
Well, I think at the youngest levels, less parenting, the better. In other words, let the child play at the playground, interact with their friends. You'll be surprised how creative they are and how active they can be and just how good it is for their development, just interacting with peers and doing at that level. You know, the less organization, the less rules in those situations, the better. You know, as they get older, you know, having a little bit more structure is fine. You know, should a third grader be lifting weights and doing speed strength and that kind of stuff? You know, probably just cool it a little bit and let them enjoy the sport and interact with their friends and enjoy it for what it is. Certainly when they're older and they're teenagers and they can follow rules and follow directions and do things in an appropriate way and have great techniques, I think it's totally fine to be, you know, advancing and doing a little bit more specific training in those at those age groups.
All three of my kids competed in pretty much every sport that there was. My middle son played college football. I don't know that I would make those same decisions today. If I want to learn more, how can I learn more?
There are a lot of resources out there. You know, American Medical Society of Sports Medicine has some different statements on different types of injuries and youth and concussions. American College of Sports Medicine, similar. But there's also a lot of data out there, a lot of YouTubes. There's a lot of old players with different sort of platforms that talk about the pros and cons of early participation. You know, just getting the information and data, I don't think there's one specific spot that is the perfect avenue for the best information. So you do have to kind of sort out lots of different resources, but there is a lot of information out there that really can help parents make an informed decision.
Dr. Dan Osley is an orthopedic and sports medicine physician with Essentia Health. It's really been a pleasure. This is a tough issue for many parents.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, to me, a lot of it is about kind of worldly things and long-term health. You know, football is such a part of our landscape. You know, you have it on television most days of the week, and, you know, it's a big part of people's lives and homecoming, and a lot of these games revolve around the game. And so we don't want to lose, you know, part of what it's like to be an American. On the other hand, to participate in contact sports in the safest way possible and to have people just recognize that there's risks and benefits with all decisions we make.
Before we go, I read years ago, I believe, that statistically the most dangerous high school sport or activity was cheerleading. Is that what you've seen come through in your office?
So there's different ways of looking at that. Probably a good way of looking at injuries in sports is how many are injured per person or per hour of play, right? So the more athletes that participate and the more hours they play, then you can figure out how many get injured. Football would still top the list. But if you said how many cheerleaders get injured relative to how many are doing it, it is actually a little more than you would think. And certainly now, it used to just be pom-poms and doing a few real simple things, but now there's competitive cheer where they're tumbling and doing stunts and aerials. You know, we certainly, even in this community, had a tragic injury in the 80s with a cheerleader who died doing stunts at North Dakota State University. And so it hits close to home, knowing that even cheerleading has some risks and benefits, but getting safeguards in for all of our athletes, independent of what they're participating in, is really important.
Dr. Dan Osley, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
This is Bird Note. Instead of just putting your garden to bed this autumn, why not put it to work as a haven for wintering birds? Instead of dumping your leaves, rake them to cover your flower and vegetable beds. They'll smother the weeds and decompose, feeding next year's plants. And in the meantime, juncos, sparrows, and towhees will scuffle around and feed in the leaf litter. When you trim back the trees and shrubs, throw the clippings into a heap in the corner of your yard. The pile will break down into nutritious garden compost over the winter, and the song sparrows and wrens will thank you for a place to forage and roost. You can also leave the seed heads on perennial plants, purple coneflowers, sunflowers, milkweed, and more. They're a treat for finches, pine siskins, and other birds. Do you need to prune a tree or even cut it down? Well, fall is the best time of year to do it because you won't be destroying any active bird nests. And if you can leave a dead tree on your property, a snag, that can be even better for wildlife. With a little planning, your garden can be a haven for birds like this Buick's wren all year round. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Accepting applications for the Bush Fellowship now through October 15th. More information about the Bush Fellowship can be found online at bushfoundation.org/bushfellows.
It's my pleasure to be joined again with Christopher Zimmerman. He served as the music director of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra since 2013. Chris, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you very much.
We are at the beginning of the upcoming FM orchestra season. What do you think about when you put a season together?
As you might imagine, it's a fairly enjoyable part of the job because there are a lot of issues to consider or a lot of parameters to kind of fit into. It's not just choosing my favorite pieces or whatever it may be. I try the most fundamental thing is to try and create a balance of pieces which will appeal to a broad swath of the audience. But, you know, there are people who come all the time who are kind of versed in their classical music tastes, which often means, you know, the big guys from the past, like Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Brahms, whatever. But then there are, of course, new people you want to appeal to who don't have that sort of experience, and they may like a completely different type of music. So I'm thinking about that when I put the season together, a big variety. But at the same time, sometimes I'm thinking to have a kind of through theme to bind a program together, which could mean that the pieces are much more connected. We've even done, years ago, we did, for instance, an all Beethoven program. I'm not saying that's a good idea or a bad idea, but that's obviously the very opposite extreme from a completely varied diet, so to speak. So, and that's part of it, and a big part, because that's the part where you're trying to really attract the audience. Another part of it, though, is, in a sense, a more developmental, may I say, educational side, musically speaking, to try and develop the orchestra so that the orchestra aren't playing the same old thing every time, but sometimes the same old thing, especially if it's a piece that most orchestral players like. So I would put that in, but also new music to kind of, you know, develop all of us. This first concert that we just played last weekend was very much that. There was a couple of composers who were very well known, Tchaikovsky being one of them, actually, but we did a piece of his which isn't done very well, and we did other music which was unfamiliar to most of the orchestra and I think the audience. So anyway, this season, and I've had help with this. It's not all me in my ivory tower here, and I'm appreciative of the help. I talked to my colleagues and the staff about, because they live in the community, about what they feel might be an attractive balance for the audience. And in this case, we put together a kind of binding theme in that each program, I'm hesitating because it's kind of hard to explain, each program encapsulates a certain emotional state, perhaps. And you'll notice if you look at the program that they have subtitles. The one we just played, it was called Passion, and most of that program was really hot, red-blooded stuff. Passion, yes. In the sense of, yeah. There was one piece on it called Jealousy. That's actually the name of the piece. Another was called Meditation and Dance of Vengeance. The Tchaikovsky was Hamlet Overture. You know the story about Hamlet, you know. Another Vengeance one. And Carmen, for instance, we played the last scene of Carmen, which is all about love and jealousy as well. So that was the type of passion we were talking about. The next season has an overall theme of triumph. That's the kind of name. The January one is brilliance. The March concert is bliss. And the April concert is desire. So, of course, that doesn't mean something specifically, but it puts the pieces in context for that.
Does the availability of artists that you really want to have come here impact what you design and what you do?
Well, actually, that's a good question. In the case of January, that's very much the case, actually. So let me tell you a bit about that. The January concert, we are featuring for the first time two sisters, highly, highly talented sisters, who are coming to play a double concerto. And they're very, very young. I think they're like 21, very young. So they're really prodigious in that sense. And actually, one of them plays piano principally, and the other plays violin principally, but also the pianist plays violin, and the violinist plays cello. So they actually have a real thing going on there. It's extraordinary.
It's talent there.
Yeah, amazing talent. So as I said, they're young. So actually, the brilliance title of that concert feeds very much into the fact that we have them. And in fact, on that program, since you ask, we are performing with our youth orchestra side by side. That means that the youth orchestra, which is under our banner, and they play their own concerts. Once a year, they come to sit next to the professionals to play one piece in a program with us.
Great experience.
Yeah, see kind of how it works in the real world, and the real world really just meaning that they have very little time to put stuff together. They practice before, then they just rehearse with us, and that's it. So that part of youth is on that concert because of the two soloists. Also, the second half, we are playing Shostakovich's First Symphony, which he wrote when he was, I don't know if you know this, it's extraordinary, 19 years old, as a graduate, his graduate thesis from the Moscow Conservatory. I mean, the piece is fabulous. I mean, he's, what can I say, a genius, but such a prodigious one. And that is, so you see how that program kind of puts itself to, how that program is put together by the sense of youthful brilliance.
What's your audience like, Chris? You and I were talking off mic about a program that I just recently went to and I was one of the younger folks there.
Yeah.
Is it the case that you're able to attract some younger people, or are you concerned about that?
I'm concerned, but we do actually attract some. So it's a little bit of both in the sense that we could have many more. I conducted another orchestra on the East Coast, and I think the ratio here of younger to older is slightly healthier than it is there, actually, which is, that's not to say it's as good as it should be. You know, we this community, as you know, has three universities very close to each other with music programs and music schools. So we do get quite a few people, I think, who are interested, students who are interested in the experience of our concerts. But you're right, there's no doubt about it. Anyone would say this if they're being honest. I mean, the, I don't know if it goes far as saying the audience is aging out, but it is an art form which, although I think it appeals to people initially when they may be younger, at least they're curious, they kind of come back to it at a later stage of life, and that's where most of our enthusiasm is. I would say probably from, I don't really know actually, but maybe the age of 45, 50 upwards, and certainly considerably older people when they're retired, et cetera, and they get this music in their blood, then they're the people who come all the time.
If there is someone who's maybe wondering now just for a moment, would this be good for me? What one piece or two should they search for right now and listen to really get a feel for what you bring to the FM Symphony Orchestra?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, but I think it's very hard to say because people really have, which is great, really have different tastes. So for me to answer that, it might be my taste a bit.
What's your taste?
But I would say...
You want to do exciting.
I'm looking at the program, actually, of the year. If we could do that. So I would take three pieces. I'd try to take three different pieces, maybe. So the concert we just had, it was really, you know, sort of furiously intense music. I think we played Salome, Richard Strauss, who writes big opulent orchestral music. The Dance of the Seven Veils by him would be, it's only about 10 minutes long. It's full of color and rhythm and emotional intensity. There's tons in it for 10 minutes. And the orchestra's so large and so varied in sound that I feel that if you come to it with an open mind, you couldn't help but be beguiled by simply the color palette of the music. So that would be a good one. I think also The Lark Ascending, say, which we're doing later in the year. Again, another small piece, but so tuneful and beautiful and evocative. That's by Vaughan Williams, the English composer. And I think in the last concert, Symphony No. 3 by Gustav Mahler, that's a huge piece, huge. But we're playing just the last movement. That's on the Desire program. And that this particular movement of that symphony has a subtitle, What Love Tells Me, and is absolutely gorgeous. So, you know, those three pieces are very different from each other, but would give a sense of what all the fuss is about for us who love this stuff.
We're enjoying our conversation with Christopher Zimmerman. He is the music director of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra at the beginning of their 2024-2025 season. Are you getting better as a music director, and what does that mean?
Am I getting better? I suppose the experience counts for quite a lot, right? At this point, I've got quite a lot of experience. I never know quite what getting better. I mean, you say as a music director, if you meant as a conductor, musician.
Oh, maybe.
It's because they are two, actually, they're not completely different because the leadership side of the conducting, I don't know the answer to that really. As with respect to the musical, trying to improve the musical product, I hope better through experience because I think in any profession, this is probably right, you know, the older you get in the sense of the more experience you have, I think when things don't go the way you expect them to, you have a calmer approach, therefore a more focused approach on how to maybe make it to deal with the situation, right? So when I was younger, I actually, sometimes when I've taught, and this can actually translate into physical gestures in front of the orchestra for a conductor. You know, when I was younger...
I had this look of daggers just staring right at me if I were in the orchestra.
No, I admonish students, I'm probably very hypocritical about this. It's actually not necessarily the size of the gestures, but don't physically shout at the orchestra. Don't shout. In other words, when you try to deliver some information with your gestures, make it count for something. doesn't mean it has to be tiny and always, you know, understated, but it means it has some meaning, which I know for people who think conductors, and they're right, just wave their arms around, they are signals, though. So I think, and in rehearsal, for instance, instructing people or leading people or trying to encourage people to play in the way you want them to do it in a way which is not overly, you know, shouting. I mean that word metaphorically, mm-hmm. actually, not volume-wise. So
your body language as your...
Yeah, and speaking, though, even, you know, mm-hmm. what the type of instruction you might want to give, you know, just try and be sensitive and concise. That sort of thing, I think, gets, at least I feel, gets better as I do more of it.
Where in the world is the music you bring to the FM Symphony, where in the world is that most appreciated, and why would that be?
You mean literally in the world?
Mm-hmm. Literally. Where in the world is classical music most appreciated? Where in the world is orchestral music? Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, I don't think it is in this country the most, but I mean, it's, you know, it's not. I mean, there's this sense that its time is sort of running out, and the, you know, people, I'm hesitating because it's kind of hard to explain, but people understandably think that it belongs to a kind of earlier era almost on a purely technological basis. So there is so much in the world now to get one's attention that it can be overridden. So I'm thinking, for instance, there's a scene in a Jane Austen, and I don't know which one it is, where there's someone in the salon playing the piano, a visitor arrives, right? This person sits down at the piano, and all the young girls in the household come immediately to the top of the stairs to listen intently to this. Now, that, of course, would never happen now, but that happened, I think, because that was such a major event. I mean, there's nothing else going on entertainment-wise, right? So this person going to play the piano in their house was a momentous occasion. Well, now, I mean, a symphony orchestra, you're competing with God knows what. Opposite, in a way, of a momentous occasion for most people with all the other stuff that you can do. You know, and educationally speaking, in this country, it's very healthy in terms of, you know, every orchestra. I mean, Fargo's a great example. Not every orchestra, every university has ample opportunity for people to play instruments together in an ensemble, be it band or, you know, a wind band or a string group or a band or marching band or whatever. This is all quite healthy here. The through line of, you know, the education of this art form, though, as a whole, gets cut quite a lot. And I think both those things together need to be stronger in order to really, for someone to maintain a genuine interest in the music. To answer your question, when you said where...
At what country?
Yeah, so I, as you may know, actually, the Far East now. But you see, it's a newer art form, right? So it's very interesting for them. Japan, for a long time now, I say long time, maybe 60, 70 years, because it's a Western art form which has gone into their society now, is something that they're very keen on, I think. China too, actually, more and more, for the same reasons. And in Southeast Asia, where it hasn't even matured as much as it has in, you know, in China and Japan, it's only getting stronger. Europe is still, I think, in many ways, for the educational reasons I just mentioned earlier, is in better shape in that respect than the United States. I'm not trying to suggest United States is a bunch of heathens. That's not what I'm saying. But it's not quite at the forefront as much as Europe. But everywhere in the West, it's becoming more and more, I think, of a challenge for those reasons I was explaining before, I think. Multimedia, internet, that sort of thing.
Podcast. There's so much asking us.
I think so.
Of our time. My favorite orchestra at the University of Wyoming, Chris, was not the very formal music major orchestras. They had an orchestra that performed every year for non-music majors.
Yeah.
And they had a class for engineers, for business majors, and they all came together with music, and I just thought it was just grand.
It's great.
Very successful. Yeah. Very successful.
I mean, that's heartening, I think. Yeah.
Let's go through the concert list for the rest of this season, if we would formally. Chris, what is on our agenda here?
Well, I explained, you know, earlier about the kind of what's behind the programming as a whole. And there's something I left out, which I think is quite important, to me at least, which is playing, okay, so the, you know, symphony orchestra pieces which have been written quite a long time ago, as in these composers like Beethoven, Brahms, Bach, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, etc. But of course, it's an ongoing art form, obviously, and at some point they were completely new and someone had to perform their music in order for these great works to see the light of day. I'm very sensitive to that because I think if we're going to keep going, you know, speaking to your last question, we need to be able to perform pieces which have been written today. So I make a point as much as I can. I mean, that in itself is actually quite an interesting task to either commission a composer to write a piece for us or to get a piece which is out there, which we will bring to the orchestra and hopefully galvanize some interest in it. And this season, I'm proud to say we are, I'm trying to remember, we have, for instance, the next concert coming up, we are performing a piano concerto, which will be the first time in, actually the second time in the country, because the first time I'm actually performing it on the East Coast by other orchestra, that's the USA premiere. This will be the second performance
when is
in this
that?
Country. It's called Force Majeure. It's a piano concerto.
When will that be performed?
In November, in our November concert. And also, and that concert, it's that piece is, that concerto is written by an Australian lady. We're also performing a piece by an American composer, a very young man called Quinn Mason, who actually, we did a piece of his 2 years ago. And we're doing another piece of his, which is also for the first time in this part of the country. So there are two new pieces on that program. And then in April, we're also doing another piece for the first time in this part of the country. This is a concerto for cello, guitar, and orchestra, which is kind of a strange mix in our world, by a Brazilian composer. Her name is Clarice Assad. So, you know, there are three already which are new.
I consider what you do from the performer's perspective. Are there a growing number of composers in our country who are now giving us music, or is that number dwindling too? What's your perspective about those who are writing?
I think that's really healthy. I think it's not dwindling at all. I think actually the opposite. I mean, I'm not sure if it's growing, I don't really know, but certainly not dwindling. So that is a healthy sign. I'm really pleased about that. You know, the people who say this music is sort of fading, well, I was even saying that before, in the long term, I don't think that's the case in terms of the actual creation of the music itself. I was referring more to the size of the audience. I mean, and there'll always be a deeply motivated and captive audience, I think, for this music, but it may be getting smaller. But when it comes to composers, I think there's no issue there at all. I mean, I get you won't believe this, Craig, every day almost, in my, you know, email, I get people offering me their pieces all the time. I mean, all the time. It's great.
Your last best pitch to invite someone to your concerts this season, Chris?
I think that goes with what we've been talking about, particularly at the beginning of this chat, of putting this program together, the variety. Also, maybe those who I hope are listening and are a little bit intrigued, but who don't know this music very much, if they would maybe go on YouTube and just check out the three pieces I mentioned, because they're kind of short. I'll say the names again, by this composer, Richard Strauss. It's called Salome's Dance of the Seven Veils, a piece by Ralph Vaughan Williams called The Lark Ascending, and then the final movement of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 3. I think if they listen to those, they will, I hope, be intrigued by at least some of that music.
Are you still maintaining your tradition of coming to speak with the audience before the concert?
Yes, there's a pre-concert talk each time, where usually I speak a little bit, and also introduce, if there's a soloist, that person, and we have a kind of informal chat. And so people can get a little bit behind the scenes is the idea of that.
Christopher Zimmerman, it's always a pleasure to visit with you. He's the director of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra. He's been doing that since 2013.
Yeah, I can't believe it. Time flies.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Fargo-Moorhead choral artist and conductor Michael Culleton present What Goes Around, featuring music of the sun, stars, and moon, 4 p.m. Saturday, October 19th, and 2 p.m. Sunday, October 20th, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Moorhead. Tickets available at fmchoralartist.org and at the door.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 8th. As Europe edged toward World War I in 1914, armies still relied on horsepower of the four-legged kind. Sir Douglas Haig, a British cavalry officer, said, "Airplanes and tanks are only accessories to the man on a horse." Horses and mules were needed for pulling artillery, supply wagons, and ambulances. The war required hundreds of thousands of horses. However, when the war began, the combatants did not have a sufficient supply of horses and mules. While patriotic young men eagerly lined up at recruiting centers, acquiring horses proved more challenging. It soon became clear that the warring nations needed to acquire horses from other nations. Purchasing agents quickly arrived in the United States and spread out across the country in search of suitable animals. The British Remount and Mule Purchase Commission established a shipping station at Newport News, Virginia. This station included vast corrals, veterinary facilities, and modified ships with stalls. By the fall of 1917, it is estimated that 500,000 American horses and mules had been shipped to Europe. On this date, in 1914, the Williston Graphic warned that horse prices were likely to rise dramatically. The newspaper noted that one French cavalry officer used up his horses at a rate which alarmed the War Office and the British taxpayer. Also, on this date, in 1914, the Department of Agriculture saw an opportunity for farmers to benefit from increased prices. The department advised farmers to breed horses, recommending that they mate their best working mares with their best working stallions. When European buyers arrived in North Dakota in November of that year, the Grand Forks Herald echoed concerns about rising prices, noting that the scarcity of these animals is driving up the price. With only 20,000 tractors in the entire United States, farmers, still reliant on horses and mules, felt the impact. These warnings proved accurate. At the beginning of 1914, a workhorse could be bought for $50 to $75. By December, a European buyer in Oaks purchased horses for $175 each, and by the end of the war, 4 years later, prices had doubled. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Tomorrow, we'll take you to a small town in Michigan, where the Trump campaign is recruiting poll watchers for Election Day.
I'm going to trust their boots-on-the-ground statements more than anything I'll see on TV.
That has poll workers anxious about what that would mean for them. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's episode of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking with Wes Anderson, curator of the Barnes County Historical Society, about Valley City's recent recognition by the National Park Service as one of eight American World War II heritage cities for 2024. We'll explore the city's incredible contributions to the war effort, from the 164th Infantry's involvement in the Pacific Theater to local businessman Herman Stern's efforts to rescue over 120 German Jews. It's an honor that highlights Valley City's significant historical role during World War II. That's tomorrow, here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.